Hey listeners, thanks for tuning in again. And to those who are joining us for the first time, welcome. Sometimes I wonder what you are doing when you click the play button for Immigrant Leap. I normally listen to podcasts when I am driving, but honestly, whatever you are doing, I am so grateful that you're spending this hour with me, my thoughts, and our amazing guest. So today I'm going to talk about something that I have very limited knowledge about, and I am so excited to learn about yoga together. Growing up in Pakistan, I was hardly ever exposed to yoga, maybe because the practice was deemed religious rather than cultural. But when I came to America, how yoga was practiced and who it was practiced by made me extremely uncomfortable. If it makes any sense, I felt like yoga to me seemed colonized because majority of yoga instructors, places of practice and marketing was white and whitened. When I saw how it was being misused, it hurt and I thought it was extremely unfair. But recently, with more diverse voices and activism around yoga, I found myself curious to understand the roots. We also did, if you guys follow us on Instagram, a post about how to decolonize yoga, which became extremely popular. So we thought, you know what, we should have a guest who can talk about this in detail. Our today's guest is going to do just that. Susanna Barkataki is a renowned yoga speaker, teacher, and therapist. Her mission is to explore and integrate yogic values into our everyday and build awareness, equity, and diversity within the yoga community. She's the director of education for Ignite Yoga and Wellness Institute and also the creator of the Honor Don't Appropriate Yoga Summit. She has such depth and experience to share, and I can't wait for you to listen to her episode. So here we go.
And so there is an importance, I think, of centering and always acknowledging and uplifting South Asian voices and Desi voices in yoga, particularly. Kind of the way, you know, if we were going to have a sweat lodge ceremony, I wouldn't have a sweat lodge without a native person, an indigenous to the United States person leading it.
Susanna, thank you so much for coming on my show. I am so excited.
I'm really thrilled to be here with you, Sadia. Thank you for having me.
So I was introduced to your work recently because we were doing this post on how to decolonize yoga, and we referenced your work. And I am in awe of the kind of work that you're doing and the kind of inclusivity and diversity you're talking about. Not many people do that, especially yoga instructors. But before we get into all of that, I want to start with the basics. Let's define yoga. How do you define yoga? Is it a cultural practice? Is it a spiritual practice? Where did it originate? Can you give us a history lesson of sorts on that?
Absolutely. I love this question because yoga really is a science of personal and social liberation. And it's been organized, codified, and developed, particularly by brown people in the Saraswati River Valley in what now we call India and Pakistan. You know, for thousands and thousands of years, there were people practicing these different kind of mind-body-spirit practices based in earth-based spirituality in order to find liberation for themselves and for others. Those practices, there are many different ways that they occurred, but there are some kind of similar themes to them, which are like tapas practice, a fire or heat-building practice. There are, you know, personal renunciation practices as well. So like letting go of attachments in the world and focusing on how can we get to a transcendent experience. Ethics, yoga ethics, and what is the best way to live? What is an ideal person? How can one reach or attain that ideal? And what are some of the practices that bring us towards that ideal? And then also sovereignty. You know, it's a practice that is aimed at bringing self-governance, self-rule, autonomy to an individual so that despite experiences or outer circumstances, one has control and autonomy over one's own life. All of those things are really unique parts of the yoga system that aren't found in other spiritual philosophical belief systems around the world. And so I think that makes it a unique contribution to what we understand as like the human condition and ways to deal with the human condition. And so historically, all of this was happening somewhere around, we have dating to around 2,500 years ago, around the time of the Buddha, and we have textual evidence, so in the Vedas. But from what my teachers have said, Indian teachers, so like Shankarji, who is practicing and teaching in Bihar, and other teachers in North India, that practice may have been going on for thousands of years before that. In fact, that it was just transmitted orally. We don't have anything that we can point to in written record in the same way that Western, you know, kind of like scientific inquiry wants to say, oh, well, here's the proof. You know, this is an oral tradition. And, you know, from teacher to student, it's been passed down. And so I would say yoga history is, it's a vast, complex system of ethics, of knowledge, of spiritual wisdom that has been practiced anywhere from probably about 5,000 BCE to even before that.
So, Susanna, how were you introduced to yoga? Was there a person who introduced you to this way of connected existence, or did you learn about it on your own?
You know, so amazing. I would say many things in my life conspired to bring me to a yogic way of being. And in fact, it was the experience of separation. I was born in England and came into a world that didn't want me to exist because my mother is British, my father is Indian. And so there's a lot of separation, a lot of just like, don't have children, you shouldn't be married, you know, all of that. And that was the world that I came into. And then as I was young, there was a lot of violence against my family and other folks like me and other Indians and Pakistanis in England. And so we had to leave the country. When I think of my introduction to yoga, I actually see it as an introduction to separation rather than unity. And through all that, what I had were the teachings, the practices, the values of my culture, right? Of my family culture. And so my father, my mother, but in particular, it was the practices and teachings of my father. And then when we immigrated to the United States, we moved to Los Angeles, where my Assamese and Bengali family, so these are regions in Northeast India, my family from India was living. And so I was kind of grew up with yoga ethics. And it wasn't like my aunts or my uncles or my father was like, hey, this is something from the Yoga Sutras. You know, they didn't always teach it explicitly, but it was like, oh, you have, you know, this conflict at school, here's some wisdom to apply, right? Or you're having a hard time falling asleep, here's a particular practice of visualizing light and using it to relax your body. And so it was really just woven into my daily life through, you know, values and practices. And I would say, I'm curious if your answer to this question actually, because not everyone, but a lot of South Asians that I talk to, this is our answer, right? And it's like we weren't explicitly taught, many of us weren't taught yoga or yoga ethics. It was just sort of there and around and like folk knowledge, folk wisdom, and a way of being.
So it's so interesting you ask that. I said something in my intro as well, like Pakistan and India were part of the Indian subcontinent before partition. And because of that, we share some cultural practices and traditions. Unfortunately, yoga was not one of them. Now, it may be because I grew up in a family where it wasn't practiced, but I've asked other friends as well. And my exposure to yoga came when I came to the US. The way yoga was being misused or how yoga was being appropriated, I at the time was so turned off that I stopped practicing yoga or even getting to know more about it. I would be curious to know if you know other Pakistanis who practiced yoga when they were back home or they practiced yoga growing up, but I have not really come across many who did.
This speaks to like the harm of colonization and the harm that's been done to so many of our communities, because also the way I understand it is that yoga is, it's an earth-based and elemental practice that developed alongside many different religions, such as Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, later Islam, but it never was the purview of just one religion. And yet nowadays it's used, especially by a Hindu nationalist and fundamentalist government in India. It's used to say, well, yoga was always just Hindu, and to practice yoga, you know, we've got this like weird dichotomy of in the West, yoga is so watered down. And then in India, of course, not by everyone, but by the government narrative, one must be Hindu or it is a Hindu practice to do yoga. And so I think that some of that is the harm of colonization that, first of all, broke our lineages so we couldn't connect with these indigenous practices that belong to all of us. And then second is like the way that then it's compartmentalized and said this belongs to some and not to others.
I was thinking about this a few days back as to why yoga was not adopted when India was divided. And this is something that I thought of, that maybe yoga was conceptualized, at least in Pakistan, as a religious practice.
I think that has a lot to do with it. And those divisions, although, you know, of course, through the history of India and Pakistan, Sri Lanka, you know, what we broadly refer to as South Asia, have been there for thousands of years. There's also been lots of peaceful coexistence of sharing and trading of ideas. And I think that the colonial project of the British in India really heightened that. So there's been this like division and separation and erasure.
So let's talk about colonization. You've mentioned it, colonialism. You wrote in a blog post way back in 2018 what you think it means to decolonize one's yoga practice. And we will talk about this later in the show. But before that, I want to share something that you said. And I was struck by this line, and I quote, "To be colonized is to become a stranger in your own land." Susanna, what did you mean by that? And what are you referring to here? Are you talking about when you go back to India, do you feel a stranger in that land? Or are you referring to colonialism and how Indians were made to feel like strangers in their own land and they were dehumanized by the British?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So in a way, I'm talking about all of it. And actually, in that moment, I was thinking about how when I go to a yoga class, yoga is the site of our cultural heritage, right? It was born in South Asia. It was developed and codified for thousands of years. But when I walk into that space, one, not only do I not see anyone who looks like me or speaks like me or has the cultural understandings or background that I do, but two, I don't even feel like I belong. And this is, someone could say, oh, but that's just you, Susanna, and you have something to get over. But here's the thing. Every single South Asian, Sri Lankan, you know, Pakistani, Indian that I have talked to who practices yoga in the West, you know, so we're talking like European nations, countries, the United States, Australia, says the same thing. I don't belong. I don't belong. And so to become a stranger in our own land is like in the land there broadly, it's like our cultural heritage, our spiritual understanding. Yeah. Now, this does echo, for example, in Shimla, which is a hill station in the northern part of India. It's beautiful and is where a lot of people go to honeymoon and have a vacation. It's cooler. People go up from Delhi. So I went there when I was living and working in Bihar. I took a break in the hot season and went up to Shimla. And I was studying and practicing there and also interviewing villagers for research on yoga and on our indigenous traditions. And villager after villager who lived there, I interviewed about 10 people, and they all said, you know, under the time of British occupation, political occupation, we were not allowed, our grandfathers were not allowed, our grandmothers were not allowed to walk on this main thoroughfare So like Shimla has this beautiful kind of like all these shops and restaurants you know, I'm sure it wasn't much different even 100 or 60, 80 years ago during the occupation. But Indians were not allowed to walk on their own land because why, right? Well, one, because there was a narrative that said they were less than, that said they were inferior and said that this beautiful resource was and should be only available to the superior people, the British. And because of that narrative, that is the unseating, the undoing of Indians' own power and literally autonomy, Swadhyaya, you know, or Swaraj, self-rule in their own land. And so that is it's like such a tragic experience to have heard that and like hear the pain in those folks' voices, you know, and when they were talking about like this beauty that you now get to behold. Like my parents, my grandparents couldn't do that. And that's what's happening in the yoga world today is in the very sight of our own heritages and practices, which aren't without complexity, but we're essentially erased, or we have been erased. So the dominant culture can take over and can do their way with it and make it what they want.
I remember going to a couple of yoga classes, and you know what really turned me off was yoga instructor slapping on either Namaste or Om randomly somewhere, right? Either in the beginning or at the end without contextualizing it. Now, I grew up watching Bollywood films, okay? And I am pretty much exposed to the words and the terms used in India, for instance, Namaste. I grew up with it. But at the same time, I will say this, it has a spiritual connotation. It has a spiritual context that is not valued or shared through yoga instructors, which to me is such a big disservice. Why do you think that is the case? And I would even ask you, do you think it is appropriate to use these terms if yoga instructors don't understand them?
There's so much depth to this tradition, and it is a rich and complex spiritual and philosophical and ethical tradition. The East and all of our different peoples and cultures have so much to offer the world. When we cut out in the West the complexity of this worldview or of these tools that can help us answer big questions like what is the best way to be, or you know, how should I live, or what can I do in my life to reduce suffering and bring myself more liberation, freedom? We're really missing an opportunity to learn and to grow as a humankind. And so, yes, I think it is such a huge disservice to everyone, actually, to leave out or water down what yoga is. And so specifically around Namaste, which has such a beautiful meaning. In my experience, Namaste is used as a greeting. It's used as a greeting to my elders, you know, and respected teachers. And it's something that that I like. It's imbued with a almost like a diaphanous or a hard to attain essence of love, of respect. And so to make it like kind of take it and use it as a fancy way of saying like, get out the door, we're done.
Exactly.
You know, it's so disrespectful. What I try to help people understand is it's important to understand the culture that you're connecting with. Have a relationship with the source culture. So it doesn't mean that if you're not Indian or Pakistani or Sri Lankan or, you know, Afghani, that you shouldn't practice yoga. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is understand the culture from the inside out and then learn about the practices and traditions so you can relate to it respectfully instead of like appropriating or doing harm.
And as you said, to be honest, when it comes to yoga, even for somebody like me, having grown up in Pakistan, I approach yoga with a lot of curiosity and lack of knowledge. Admittingly, that this is not the practice I grew up with. It has a lot of spiritual and cultural significance that I am not aware of. I'm assuming even people in Afghanistan don't practice it as much. Susanna, here I want to talk about cultural appropriation versus cultural appreciation, because I'm sure listeners who are listening, they may be like, yeah, but it's okay, you know, it's just a practice. It transcends cultures, it transcends religions. So why can't we customize it or make it our own? Can you give us an example of when it is okay to do something, especially within yoga space, and when it's not okay? And how do we distinguish between cultural appropriation versus cultural appreciation?
Cultural appropriation always involves two things. And one is a power imbalance, you know, so one group having more systemic power than the other, and two, harm to the source culture that is being, you know, the resources are being taken from. You know, for example, if I go and eat in a Thai restaurant, I'm not Thai, but I go and enjoy a lovely meal, and then I pay for that meal, say thank you, leave a great review, that's not cultural appropriation, you know, because I guess in terms of power, there's kind of an equality there. I'm not causing harm. But if I was to go to Thailand and take a Thai custom or Thai designs or Thai necklaces that were particular to that culture and then bring it to the West, package it, market it, and sell it, you know, using all of the Thai traditions, being not from Thailand, that would be appropriation. So we see that all over the place in the yoga world, right? People go into our tradition and they take something like mala beads, and you know, in a mala bead, it's a spiritual technology, it's a tool for focus, for pratyahara, for focusing the mind, using the mala for japa, for meditation on a particular mantra, or even just focusing on the breath. And so it's a tool of pure liberation, you know, and freedom. And just to give context, one of my main teacher, Shankarji, before I met him, he had been on retreat doing sadhana for about 10 years in a hut. And all he had in there with him, besides a change of clothes, was a Bhagavad Gita, copy of the Gita, and a mala, a wooden sandalwood mala. When I met him, he had come out of his sadhana time and was in an external teaching time, which I was very lucky to get to connect with. And he treated these belongings, you know, the mala and the Gita, with so much reverence and respect. And when I left India to come back to the United States to do some more work here, he gave me the gift of both of those books, the book and the mala. And I can't tell you, you know, it was just like such a powerful gift. Like, imagine 10 years of daily sadhana, daily practice in this physical object that it's there. You know, why did he give it? Well, because he wasn't attached to the thing. It was a tool for the spiritual attainment, a tool for growth, a tool for practice. And so just in sharing that, I practice with the mala bead and my own sadhana, and I read the Gita. And so I share that to say, you know, that's a combined now like 15, 18 years of practice from my teacher and now myself with these objects. So they're not just like fashion accessories or tools to be like taken and cast off. And so, for example, a mala has that much depth and weight and significance, but then certain jewelry companies or, you know, all many yoga spaces across the U.S., they go and they either source malas or they go and they actually buy malas at a very low price, and then they bring them back and sell them as jewelry. And so people pick their malas as necklaces, as something to coordinate with their yoga outfits. That would be cultural appropriation for two reasons, right? Because one, causes harm. It's watering down the purpose of this spiritual vehicle, this spiritual tool. But two, those artisans who made the mala, who maybe toiled for days or even weeks to hand make and bead those malas, they're getting, you know, maybe 50, 100 rupees, like it's less than a dollar. And then they're sold here for 50, 60, 80, $150. So there is a complete harm of exploitation, right? Of taking from the source culture, watering it down, and then not giving back to where, to the people from whom this has come. So that would be a clear example of appropriation.
That's a great example, because people can basically, through this example, understand if they've been engaging in cultural appropriation or not. Susanna, have you called out people on, you know, cultural appropriation or practices that you deem completely wrong?
Yes, and I think this is so important, right? Like, we're in a culture where there is so much harm. There's just harm everywhere. And when, even if we take the yogic practice of ahimsa, of non-harm, we cannot be perfect at not harming. Even I myself, right, cause harm at times, or don't do things perfectly, or you know, and so even myself, I should personally, as should anyone, have an eye to, well, where can I share power and where can I uplift the source culture materially, you know, concretely. And so in doing this work, sometimes, you know, people send me like, oh, there's just terrible ones, like images of like using the word namaste with underwear, you know, or putting a deity from the tradition on a toilet seat or on the butt of some cute shorts, you know. And it's just like, it's actually so painful, you know. It's painful because there's the harm of disrespect. And so sometimes I do call out organizations, and I think, so as a, I see myself as a yoga unity activist. I work on many different ways. I know folks listening can't see, but maybe you can imagine like a pen or a pencil. And so sometimes I work from the outside, like trying to change structures or systems, like trying to change a big company, and I'm railing against them or trying to boycott, things like that. Sometimes I actually work within and I consult to these organizations and try to make changes in that way. And then sometimes I create whole new systems. You know, there's really so many ways to do this work. And so one of them is definitely calling out, but it's sometimes it's like after banging our heads against the wall, like I just had this experience with a yoga jewelry company, and they came to me because they wanted to, well, they had gotten called out, right? I hadn't been the one to call them out, but I very well could have been. And they wanted to do better. But at the same time, after I spent, you know, an hour of free labor, which these are those moments where I'm like, why did I do that? They were like, well, but we're all one. And there's so many different perspectives on this. And we have some people telling us that it's okay. So we're not going to change anything. And it's like, wait, you just heard that you're causing harm to all of these people. And because it's inconvenient for you, you're not going to change anything, you know? And so these are those moments where I just have to turn my attention, instead of calling out, to building a different world, like to working with other South Asians, with other people who, you know, Black and Brown people, to be like, hey, we're here, you know, and we're rocking it out. We're having a great time. If you want, come join us, as opposed to trying to change these old dinosaur companies that just don't get it. And it's like, they're going to, I certainly think they're going to be gone soon. I don't think they're going to last through the next decade if they don't listen to what all of us are saying.
This is such an important point. And you're absolutely right. There are so many companies out there who have co-opted this old tradition and cheapened it to solely either a mode of exercise or marketable accessories, which is extremely painful to watch. But Susanna, having worked within, outside, as you mentioned, you try as a yoga instructor to promote diversity and inclusion through different avenues. Which, in your opinion, has been more effective?
I love this. No one's asked me this. Like, of everything you do, which is actually the most effective?
Yeah.
That's a great question. So, honestly, I'm a teacher, I'm a writer, I'm an activist, right? Those are the ways that I think my work kind of flows through. And that article, that actually the first time I published it was in 2015, the one that was like, decolonize how to decolonize your yoga practice. And that was really impactful. It was me writing like that raw howl of, this is so wrong. Like, I'm seeing it, I'm feeling it on a visceral level. I had just come back from a puja at my aunt's house, and I was like, I can't believe this is happening. And people resonated with that. So that was really impactful. So I'm actually going to answer with a few things in each category, right? So writing, blogging from my heart. Now, I want to make sure people understand. I had been writing, blogging every week for a year up until that point. And honestly, it was crickets, right? So ineffective, ineffective, ineffective. And then that was an off book, off schedule, had a not planned, just wrote from the heart, hit publish, shared it on social, and woke up to like 150 shares and 500 likes, which I had never experienced before, right? So all of a sudden, strangers were reading my words and resonating and sharing. And that, to me, when I'm looking at these things, I'm looking at impact, right? Clearly it had impact, and it was something that resonated. So that was really impactful on a writing scale. Since then, I then tried to like get myself into, and other folks like me, into yoga spaces, you know, conferences, summits, trainings. And guess what? From 2015 to 2018, so 3-4 years, because it was the beginning of 2015 to the end of 2018, nothing. Like, nobody cared about the work that the training I'd had, the studies I'd done in India, the things I had to share. Nobody platformed me or any of my colleagues, Indian, South Asian colleagues. It just wasn't happening. So I was very frustrated. And at that moment, I decided to create a summit called the Honor Don't Appropriate Yoga Summit. And I was like, forget you all. This is like back to that pen, right? Instead of working with the systems that exist, it's like, we're going to create our own damn summit, right? We can't get a foot in the door. We can't, you know, you won't give us a seat at the table. We'll create our own table. And so it took a lot of work, a lot of just like blood, sweat, and tears, a lot of learning. And what was so impactful about it, one, was that it wasn't really about me. It was about platforming and uplifting many different voices, Black and brown primarily, and South Asian primarily, voices in the yoga world today. And then white folks who were allies for this work and wanted to have a conversation about these things and understood the importance of the conversation. And then, so that was incredibly impactful, because I think everyone, you know, who cares or is interested in yoga in any way is like, there's something more here. And in general, I think yoga practitioners of all backgrounds want to learn and want to grow. And so this gave them an opportunity to listen with, you know, like 26 teachers and experts for many hours and learn and go deeper and kind of open their minds. And so that had about 10,000 people sign up for it. So again, it was like, this was really impactful. And my goal with it was to change the face of yoga in the West. So no more could someone throw together a conference or summit or workshop and have it be all white and be like, oh, we couldn't find any, you know, South Asian or Indian or Desi teachers. They just couldn't say that, because this had now happened and we were all there. And since then, there's been so many wonderful outgrowths. Different people have, you know, come into doing their own projects. I think Yoga is Dead podcast is one of them, does incredible work. And, you know, there's just more and more and more of us out here raising our voices up and saying, like, there's more to this story. Those two, I think, writing. And then I guess the final piece is really with education. And that would be, for me, it's sort of, again, a compromise, right? I do some workshops outside, but I also run yoga teacher trainings. And my reason for running yoga teacher trainings is like, hey, this institution that I don't agree with, you know, Yoga Alliance, like, it makes no sense to say 200 hours, 300 hours, you're certified to teach yoga. Like, what does that even mean, right? But if, like, this is a lifelong journey, and yoga is every moment, truly, when you're a practitioner. And yet, the people who are certifying teachers hardly know anything, because their teachers didn't know. You know, it wasn't their fault necessarily, but they're just passing on this watered down teaching. And so I started being an educator and a teacher. I just naturally started teaching as a vehicle, another vehicle for preserving the tradition more authentically and more fully.
Do you see more South Asians, more people of color learning to be yoga instructors and joining those spaces?
Absolutely, yes. The project, which is like a movement far beyond any one person or even group, but the movement is happening. Yoga in the West is diversifying. Yoga in the West is also wanting in general to return to understanding and embracing the roots of yoga. And we see that in, for me, my trainings are usually about half people of color, half white folks. So that is wonderful. I've run a number of just POC only or South Asian trainings, and that is hugely impactful. And then the numbers of South Asians who are speaking up and who are talking about these issues is growing and growing and growing, because I think we're at this time of like a critical mass as a,
right,
as a diasporic community where we've needed to assimilate. You know, my parents, my family needed to assimilate and needed to have their head down and not speak up. But myself and others my age and younger, and around my age, it's like because of the work and the labor and the sacrifices of our elders, I actually have the privilege to speak up. And though, I mean, I get blacklisted all the time. There are so many yoga organizations that will have nothing to do with me because, you know, they're just like, she's too radical or whatever, right? So there are consequences to speaking up. I don't want to act like there are not consequences. If I assimilated more, I'd be a potentially yoga celebrity, right? But that's not my goal. My goal is not that. It's like impact, right? So I think that there are so many of us now who are speaking up that our voices can't be ignored. And this is how change happens.
Absolutely. And you are an authentic voice, and that's what matters, right? I would trust you in a heartbeat versus any other yoga instructor. Now, in terms of diversity, we focused more on South Asian voices, right? What, in your opinion, does yoga look like to non-white but non-South Asian people?
Yes, Sadia, I was just thinking that. So I love that you asked this question, because this movement has to be intersectional in the West, right, in diaspora. And the reason is because at its heart, yoga is a practice of personal and social liberation. Hmm. And so for myself, as a settler colonial, right, I'm not indigenous to the United States. I live in on Seminole land, which is unceded, so stolen Seminole land. As someone who, though brown, many privileges I have are on the back of formerly enslaved Black folks. To deny those privileges and to not utilize this tradition of liberation to help make amends and to help also uplift Indigenous and Black folks in particular would be a huge mistake. And so it has to be intersectional. And so there is an importance, I think, of centering and always acknowledging and uplifting South Asian voices and Desi voices in yoga, particularly kind of the way, you know, if we were going to have a sweat lodge ceremony, I wouldn't have a sweat lodge without a Native person, an Indigenous to the United States person leading it, right? So it's
exactly.
If we're going to have a yoga event or experience, have a South Asian person there. Have, you know, 1, 2, 5, like don't tokenize, but have many, many of us there. And also uplift in the same thing, Black folks, Latinx folks, other Asians, right? So because there is a way that yoga is, you know, it didn't come just to one person, it came through, and it really is a power and a practice that is for all of us, and it's here for liberation. And so we all get to experience that. And yet part of the yoga ethics of ahimsa is a commitment not only to one's own liberation, but to ensuring the possibility of liberation for everyone else. Right. So ahimsa in it is a commitment, and really if someone is calling themselves a yogi or a yoga practitioner, as far as I've been taught, they should be living yoga ethics. The very first foundational ethic, the yama of ahimsa, non-harm, is non-harm for oneself, but then also undoing systemic oppression for others.
I was going to ask you this question, Susanna. Is yogi the appropriate title to give someone who identifies as yoga instructor? Or do you think we would be taking it out of cultural and historical context? And you've defined what being yogi really embodies. So I don't think every yoga instructor who calls themselves yogi is practicing those tenets.
Exactly. I think it's a misuse. You know, in India and in a lot of South Asia, a yogi is a renunciate. A yogi is someone who wears robes, who has renounced, you know, the trappings of the world, and also who has attained a certain level of spiritual freedom. Now, I don't personally refer to myself as a yogi except colloquially, but I do refer to people in the West as yogis. So I'll use that term because I know people relate to it. I do think we've misused, again, watered down what it is. I would refer myself as a yoga practitioner,
right,
as a student of yoga, even as a teacher of some, you know, yoga philosophy, but more than anything, as a student. And that a yogi is a really aspirational ideal. You know, even Ralph Waldo Emerson, who studied the Bhagavad Gita when he was at Walden Pond, said, "Even I, at times, now and again, am a yogi." So he understood, you know, that this is not just something that you get to say, "Oh, I'm a yogi, you know, I have my pants and I go to the studio and I teach or whatever." It's like, it's an experience of Swaraj, an experience of swa self, raj rule, of self-sovereignty. And so do I personally ever feel like I have moments of truly living and being in that unity? Yes. Are they every moment? No. You know, I have many moments of separation, many moments of not living actually in that experience of true unity. Do I and will I spend the rest of my life with that as an aim and as something I'm moving towards? Yes, that's what I'm committed to as a yoga practitioner. So I think we do need to bring a little bit more depth back to that word.
That's such an interesting point. Susanna, a lot is happening right now. I mean, politically and socially, there are times when I'm anxious. There are times when I'm outright depressed. How can we look to yoga to ground us in a more raw and common language?
Yeah, it is such a challenging time, and there are so many things happening. And I don't see it stopping in the foreseeable future. And so I think about this a lot. And the reason that I have embraced yoga as a practice is, you know, I've experienced so much suffering from what I mentioned as this inheritance of separation, this inheritance of not belonging. And although that was all happening outside of me, it also went inside. And so I'm not personally a stranger to this degree of suffering. Like, most of my early childhood was under some kind of physical onslaught. You know, I was fighting, and then internally, inferiority, lack of valuing myself, feeling like I was not worth anything. You know, all of those things have been what I was raised in, for better or worse, like because of systemic oppression. And so I had to turn to yoga turn to the very things I was being made fun of for, right? Saying, go home, you're a terrorist, you don't belong. It's like, okay, this is horrible. And I'm going to turn into the very source and site of my own cultural roots to figure out how to be more able to meet this moment, meet the world that I'm in. And so what I found is, like, because all those things happening, they impact our mind, our body, our spirit, right? Literally, I used to be so clumsy. First of all, I will say, even though I'm a yoga practitioner and teacher, I'm not flexible. I broke my femur when I was young, when I was 7, my thigh bone. I was in a cast for almost a month. on crutches for another month, you know, lost all flexibility and that I had. And it wasn't a lot before that. And you know, so I was disconnected mind and body. I'd walk around and bump into things. And so there were physical external repercussions of some of these internal, you know, oppressions. And yoga, for me, actually, the first step was it started to ground me back in my own body. I no longer felt like a head walking around with no body. You know, I started to get re-embodied because of asana, because of the physical practice. But then secondly, and this was a part that it, you know, I wrote about a lot in my book and have a whole chapter on the roots of trauma-informed yoga in yoga itself. Like, trauma-informed yoga is a field, is an incredible and, you know, pretty recent field of, well, how does yoga help realign the mind, body, spirit, link back up? I'm like putting my fingers down over my thumb with that model of the brain where you have your thumb wrapped under your fingers. And so it's like, if your fingers flip up and you've lost your, you know, lost the plot, really upset, really frustrated, how can we relink the mind, the body, all the parts of the brain so we can start to problem solve? Well, what's so impactful is that yoga does that so well. And so with our new understandings in neuroscience, we actually have words for it. But honestly, these are things that yoga practitioners have known for thousands of years. They just use different terms like ahamkara or citta, you know, or citta vritti nirodha, which is the second shloka of the Yoga Sutras, the citta, the mind, vritti, the fluctuations or the changes of the mind, nirodha, calming, easing. Yoga is a tool for the easing of the fluctuations, the changes of the mind, whether those changes happen outside of us or inside. You know, even with like the pandemic or different things that have occurred, you know, the onslaught and continued onslaught of people of color and immigrants and Asians, I get super triggered. I do, you know, I flip my lid and rightly so, because it is wrong what is happening and it needs to change. But I go into the practice and there are so many doors, dharma doors in that help me reconnect so I can be a useful, you know, like revolutionary, essentially. It's like I get linked back up so I can help continue to make change. And so I really do think whether someone wants to be a revolutionary or they just want to live their life and like raise their family and in peace and be able to kind of weather the storms that are being thrown at us as a people and culturally, yoga is, it's a really powerful practice that can be so impactful. And there are so many ways to practice that one can find something that will work for them.
Susanna, you mentioned something which is so interesting for me. You talked about how you are a yoga instructor, but sometimes you don't feel like you're as flexible. And I have felt that. I have not practiced yoga, like maybe been to a couple of classes, but I feel like I'm not flexible or I'm stiff at times. And you bring up such an important point that maybe it's, you know, that mind-body disconnect. Maybe it's how I perceive things. And maybe it's also a reflection of how I consume what's going around me, you know, externally, and how my body takes it.
Yes. You know, the sutras talk a lot about how are we digesting our experiences. And so when we digest, and there's a whole limb of yoga called pratyahara, which is one of the eight limbs, one of the many limbs of practice, of which asana is just one, the physical practice is just one. But you've got the yamas, yoga ethics, the niyama, the inner codes, asana, pranayama, breath, pratyahara, which is sense focus, right? So what you're talking about is like, how do we focus our senses and what are the ways that we can focus our senses so we're not overwhelmed? And they all work together. And so asana, the physical practice, it's not about like being flexible or doing the most elaborate pose or standing on your head or, you know, touching your toes or any of that. It's really, asana is a firm and comfortable seat. And it's sthira sukhasanam. Sthira sukham asanam, right? It's a calm, steady seat. And seat right. can literally mean seat, but it can also mean like one's own place, where your stand in the world, who you are. And so if that, you know, sthira sukhasanam is what yoga is, then anything that helps you take a firmer stand, a more comfortable or calm stand or seat is your yoga. And so it doesn't, you know, this is why it's such a misunderstanding of yoga to say that yoga, you have to be flexible or acrobatic.
Exactly. That's so interesting. You also mentioned something that I want to go back to, and we should have talked about this in the beginning, but you have mentioned a few times your internal struggle, separation, which led you to yoga. I am assuming you're referring to how you were treated or perceived because of your mixed ethnicity, right?
Yes. You know, what's what's funny in the United States and in, you know, probably in much of the Western world is it's like the one drop rule. If you're even a little brown, you're too brown. And so my experience growing up was, well, I certainly wasn't white. But then, except within my family, I wasn't necessarily Indian enough either, right? So I didn't really belong. Exactly. And I think this is the experience of many mixed people. And it's, you know, used to be called like the tragic mixed person syndrome or whatever. And we've come a long way from there in my own lifetime. I think that there's so much around identity development and really just understanding that the world around me treated me like I was other. The world around me treated me like I was inferior, was brown, was Indian. And so what I just decided to do in response to that was turn into it. Instead of saying, no, I'm not, you know, like, yes, I am. And here's what this means. And here's how I respond. And as a mixed person, mixed half white, I have privilege. I'm lighter skinned. And I have mixed privilege in terms of adjacency to whiteness. And so it's really important for someone like me, or any lighter skinned Indian or Desi or, you know, South Asian person, to address and acknowledge the ways in which we too experience the privilege that comes to us, not through any virtue of our own, but simply through benefit of circumstance, and uplift other South Asians, other Desis, other, you know, melanated folks. And for example, like in the programs that I run, I always do a reparations fund to communities in South Asia, like in India, you know, whether it's yoga education or human rights work, Black Lives Matter or some Black-led organization and Indigenous work, and then also caste, working to end caste oppression, because there are ways that I benefit from the privileges that I have. And so, again, it's not perfect, right? Like there's so much more that needs to be done to truly get to complete ahimsa, complete non-harm. But I need to do what it is that I can while acknowledging my oppression, right? Because I certainly have experienced so much discrimination and oppression, as most folks of color have, maybe not all. But I also, to experience privilege. And so acknowledging and looking at both of those, healing and addressing the first in order to also continue to uplift, so I don't pass on a cycle of violence to others.
So Susanna, we began with talking about decolonizing yoga, and I'll end it with that. What does decolonizing one's yoga practice look in person? Our listeners who are listening to this episode, how do they decolonize their yoga practice?
Yeah, so decolonization is a really powerful thing. It's not something one can just like go through a list and do once and be done with. Decolonization is changing the whole way we engage with anything, really. You know, it's like questioning and questioning assumptions. And so one, I would say, a lot of the work around decolonization is looking at the ways that the colonial worldview has infiltrated one's own thinking. So just concretely, like for me, as a young girl, believing, oh, I'm brown, I have, you know, Assamese features, I have different eyes, different nose shape, different face shape, that means I'm ugly. right? That was the message of the colonizer, of white normalcy. I had to decolonize that. I had to look at, you're not, like, I had to tell myself, literally, you are not ugly. And the messages you're getting are a colonial message. And so, but that took time. It didn't just happen overnight that I went from hating how I looked to, you know, feeling okay about how I look to now loving how I look, right? Even in my 40s, it's like, I still love what I look like. And I always will, because now to me, that love is an act of resistance to a beauty norm that told me I was never going to be enough, and that I would always fail at a standard of beauty, right? So that's just one concrete example. It's been a lifetime to decolonize my own standards of beauty to myself. And then two, so it's a process. And decolonization often involves the rematriation, or the giving back of the roots of a practice to those whose it is. So concretely, in Seminole land, decolonization would be to give the stewardship of the land to the indigenous people of this land, to the Seminole people. So working on that, right, for me as a settler colonial. Decolonization in yoga can look like, one, practicing yoga beyond just the physical, sharing, learning all of the different aspects of what yoga is, practicing that. If you're going to teach, then sharing that, looking and offering non-hierarchical different teaching and learning styles, making it accessible. And then also making sure there are folks from within the tradition represented, right? Inviting in Desi folks, South Asian folks, to do spiritual lineage acknowledgement, to share of their own roots and their own practice. And then there's so many more ways to really decolonize. I think it's like checking in, like, does this feel like it's colonized, or does it feel like it's embracing the roots of yoga? And when you feel that, something's not right, really turning into that, as opposed to avoiding it or ignoring it, and asking and making a commitment to learn. So to undoing these aspects of, like, white supremacy, such as perfectionism or rushing or, you know, all of those things, physical focus, and then turning back into all of what yoga can be. And then the last thing I would say is collaboration, you know, uplifting, which I mentioned before, vichara, which is like critical thinking, and then practicing reparations, so giving back to folks.
Thank you so much, Susanna. I know there's a book coming out soon, and we will be sharing links to the book and all information about you. But can you share some information, your IG, links to your website, so that listeners can go and check it out?
Absolutely. So my website is my name, SusannaBarkataki.com. And if you put SusannaBarkataki.com/book, you can get that free chapter I mentioned on the roots of trauma-informed yoga. Happy to share that with you. I also have a masterclass called the Namaste Masterclass, which goes much more into, like, how might you want to open your yoga class? How might you want to close it? And raises some of these questions, which is at Namaste Masterclass. And then I like to ask lots of provocative questions on Instagram. I have these kinds of conversations there too. So that's my name, Instagram.com/SusannaBarkataki. So you can find me there.
Thank you so much, Susanna. This was so good. I learned so much. And I may start, you know, practicing yoga. I think that's what I need to start doing now.
You know, Sadia, I just want to say, like, thank you so much for having me on. Thank you for the work you do. It's incredible. And this is my hope, is that folks like you and folks listening who felt like, this wasn't for me, you know, in my book, on my site, I have a list of other teachers from, you know, South Asia that we can practice with. And so maybe you'll get to see that. You'll find some other teachers who you'll resonate with. I'm thinking of, like, Melissa Shah, Arti Landrum, Tejal Patel, Jaisal Parikh. Like, there are so many amazing teachers right now who, because of where we are, you can practice with online. And I just want to say, like, let's find a way in for all of us who have felt like this doesn't belong to us, you know? And so I hope that that does happen for you and for everyone listening.
Thank you so much, Susanna. What a great conversation. So if you are like me and are hesitant to practice yoga because of who is teaching it, I think Susanna's episode gives us a roadmap of what to do. We can seek out South Asian yoga instructors. We can look for them online, especially during COVID. Or if you are someone who is practicing yoga but has been unconsciously or unknowingly harming the practice because you don't know about the cultural or spiritual relevance of yoga practice, it's time for some introspection, some education. There are a lot of tools out there. You can check out Susanna's website, you can check out her Instagram, and also give credit where it's due. That's the most important thing. Until next time, when we have another incredible guest. Oh, by the way, we have our Instagram and Twitter. Don't forget to follow our Instagram @immigrantlypod and our Twitter @immigrantly_pod. Take care.